Children of Dune by Frank Herbert, continued, Cassette 2, Side 1. Face dancers and little people from the suspected artisan planets of the Tlaalaxu bounced and gyrated through the throng in bright clothing. There were lean faces and fat, water-rich faces. The susurration of nervous feet came from the gritty plastia which formed the wide steps, and occasionally a keening voice would rise out of the cacophony in prayer,
Muad'Dib! Muad'Dib! Greet my soul's entreaty! You who are God's anointed, greet my soul! Muad'Dib!
Nearby among the pilgrims, two mummers played for a few coins, reciting the lines of the currently popular Disputation of Armistead and Leandra. The preacher cocked his head to listen. The mummers were middle-aged city men with bored voices. At a word of command, the young guide described them for the preacher. They were garbed in loose robes, not even deigning to simulate still suits on their water-rich bodies. Asan Tariq thought this amusing, but the preacher reprimanded him. The mummer who played the part of Leandra was just concluding his oration.
Bah! The universe can be grasped only by the sentient hand. That hand is what drives your precious brain, and it drives everything else that derives from the brain. You see what you have created, you become sentient, only after the hand has done its work.
A scattering of applause greeted his performance. The preacher sniffed, and his nostrils recorded the rich odors of this place. Uncapped esters of poorly adjusted stillsuits, masking musks of diverse origin, the common flinty dust, exhalations of uncounted exotic diets, and the aromas of rare incense which already had been ignited within Alia's temple and now drifted down over the steps in cleverly directed currents. The preacher's thoughts were mirrored on his face as he absorbed his surroundings.
We have come to this, we Fremen!
A sudden diversion rippled through the crowd on the landing. Sand dancers had come into the plaza at the foot of the steps, half a hundred of them tethered to each other by a lack of ropes. They obviously had been dancing thus for days, seeking a state of ecstasy. Foam dribbled from their mouths as they jerked and stamped to their secret music. A full third of them dangled unconscious from the ropes, tugged back and forth by the others like dolls on strings. One of these dolls had come awake, though, and the crowd apparently knew what to expect.
I have seen! The newly awakened dancer shrieked. I have seen!
He resisted the pull of the other dancers, darted his wild gaze right and left.
Where this city is, there will be only sand. I have seen!
A great swelling laugh went up from the onlookers. Even the new pilgrims joined it. This was too much for the preacher. He raised both arms and roared in a voice which surely had commanded worm riders.
Silence!
The entire throng in the plaza went still at that battle cry. The preacher pointed a thin hand toward the dancers, and the illusion that he actually saw them was uncanny.
Did you not hear that man? Blasphemers and idolaters, all of you! The religion of Muad'Dib is not Muad'Dib. He spurns it as he spurns you. Sand will cover this place. Sand will cover you.
Saying this, he dropped his arms, put a hand on his young guide's shoulder, and commanded,
Take me from this place.
Perhaps it was the preacher's choice of words.
He spurns it as he spurns you.
Perhaps it was his tone. Certainly something more than human, a vocality trained surely in the arts of the Bene Gesserit voice, which commanded by mere nuances of subtle inflection. Perhaps it was only the inherent mysticism of this place where Muad'Dib had lived and walked and ruled. Someone called out from the landing, shouting at the preacher's receding back in a voice which trembled with religious awe,
Is that Muad'Dib come back to us?
The preacher stopped, reached into the purse beneath his burqa, and removed an object which only those nearby recognized. It was a desert-mummified human hand, one of the planet's jokes on mortality, which occasionally turned up in the sand and were universally regarded as communications from Shai-Hulud. The hand had been desiccated into a tight fist, which ended in white bone scarred by sandblast winds.
I bring the hand of God, and that is all I bring, the preacher shouted. I speak for the hand of God. I am the preacher.
Some took him to mean that the hand was Muad'Dib's, but others fastened on that commanding presence and the terrible voice, and that was how Arrakis came to know his name. But it was not the last time his voice was heard.
It is commonly reported, my dear Giorad, that there exists great natural virtue in the mélange experience. Perhaps this is true. There remain within me, however, profound doubts that every use of mélange always brings virtue. Meseems that certain persons have corrupted the use of mélange in defiance of God. In the words of the Ecumenon, they have disfigured the soul. They skim the surface of mélange, and believe thereby to attain grace. They deride their fellows, do great harm to godliness, and they distort the meaning of this abundant gift maliciously. Surely a mutilation beyond the power of man to restore. To be truly at one with the virtue of the spice, uncorrupted in all ways, full of goodly honor, a man must permit his deeds and his words to agree. When your actions describe a system of evil consequences, you should be judged by those consequences and not by your explanations. It is thus that we should judge Muad'Dib. The Pedant Heresy. It was a small room, tinged with the odor of ozone, and reduced to a shadowy grayness by dimmed glow globes and the metallic blue light of a single trans-eye monitoring screen. The screen was about a meter wide and only two-thirds of a meter in height. It revealed in remote detail a barren, rocky valley with two Lhasa tigers feeding on the bloody remnants of a recent kill. On the hillside above the tigers could be seen a slender man in Sardaukar working uniform, Levenbrek insignia at his collar. He wore a servo control keyboard against his chest. One variform suspensor chair faced the screen, occupied by a fair-haired woman of indeterminate age. She had a heart-shaped face and slender hands, which gripped the chair arms as she watched. The fullness of a white robe, trimmed in gold, concealed her figure. A pace to her right stood a blocky man dressed in the bronze and gold uniform of a Bashar aide in the old Imperial Sardaukar. His graying hair had been closely cropped over square, emotionless features. The woman coughed, said,
"It went as you predicted, Titanic."
"Assuredly, princess," the Bashar aide said, his voice hoarse.
She smiled at the tension in his voice, asked,
"Tell me, Titanic, how will my son like the sound of Emperor Faradin the First?"
"The title suits him, princess."
"That was not my question. He might not approve some of the things done to gain him that, title." "Then again,"
she turned, peered up through the gloom at him,
"you served my father well. It was not your fault that he lost the throne to the Atreides. But surely the sting of that loss must be felt as keenly by you as by any—"
"Does the Princess Wensisia have some special task for me?" Titanic asked.
His voice remained hoarse, but there was a sharp edge to it now.
"You have a bad habit of interrupting me," she said.
Now he smiled, displaying thick teeth which glistened in the light from the screen.
"At times you remind me of your father," he said. "Always these circumlocutions before a request for a delicate, assignment."
She jerked her gaze away from him to conceal anger, asked,
"Do you really think those Lhasas will put my son on the throne?"
"It's distinctly possible, princess. You must admit that the bastard Get of Paul Atreides would be no more than juicy morsels for those two. And with those twins gone—"
He shrugged.
"The grandson of Shaddam the Fourth becomes the logical successor," she said. "That is, if we can remove the objections of the Fremen, the Landsrod, and Chome, not to mention any surviving Atreides who might—"
"Javed assures me that his people can take care of Alia quite easily. I do not count the Lady Jessica as an Atreides. Who else remains?"
"Landsrod and Chome will go where the Prophet goes," she said. "But what of the Fremen?"
"We'll drown them in their Muad'Dib's religion."
"Easier said than done, my dear Titanic."
"I see," he said. "We're back to that old argument."
"House Corino has done worse things to gain power," she said.
"But to embrace this Mahdi's religion—"
"My son respects you," she said.
"Princess, I long for the day when House Corino returns to its rightful seat of power. So does every remaining Sardaukar here on Seleucia. But if you—"
"Titanic, this is the planet Seleucia Secundus. Do not fall into the lazy ways which spread through our Imperium. Full name, complete title, attention to every detail. Those attributes will send the Atreides' lifeblood into the sands of Arrakis. Every detail, Titanic."
He knew what she was doing with this attack. It was part of the shifty trickiness she'd learned from her sister, Irulan. But he felt himself losing ground.
"Do you hear me, Titanic?"
"I hear, princess."
"I want you to embrace this Muad'Dib religion," she said.
"Princess, I would walk into fire for you, but this—"
"That is an order, Titanic."
He swallowed, stared into the screen. The Lhasa tigers had finished feeding,
and now lay on the sand completing their toilet, long tongues moving across their forepaws.
"An order, Titanic. Do you understand me?"
"I hear and obey, Princess."
His voice did not change tone. She sighed.
"Oh, if my father were only alive!"
"Yes, Princess."
"Don't mock me, Titanic. I know how distasteful this is to you. But if you set the example..."
"He may not follow, Princess."
"He'll follow."
She pointed at the screen.
"It occurs to me that the Levenbrek out there could be a problem."
"A problem? How is that?"
"How many people know this thing of the Tigers?"
"That Levenbrek, who is their trainer, one transport pilot, you, and of course..."
He tapped his own chest.
"What about the buyers?"
"They know nothing. What is it you fear, Princess?"
"My son is, well, sensitive."
"Sardaukar do not reveal secrets," he said.
"Neither do dead men."
She reached forward and depressed a red key beneath the lighted screen. Immediately, the Lhasa Tigers raised their heads. They got to their feet and looked up the hill at the Levenbrek. Moving as one, they turned and began a scrambling run up the hillside. Appearing calm at first, the Levenbrek depressed a key on his console. His movements were assured, but as the cats continued their dash toward him, he became more frenzied, pressing the key harder and harder. A look of startled awareness came over his features, and his hand jerked toward the working knife at his waist. The movement came too late. A raking claw hit his chest and sent him sprawling. As he fell, the other tiger took his neck in one great fanged bite and shook him. His spine snapped.
"Attention to detail," the princess said.
She turned, stiffened as Titanic drew his knife. But he presented the blade to her, handle foremost.
"Perhaps you'd like to use my knife to attend to another detail," he said.
"Put that back in its sheath, and don't act the fool," she raged. "Sometimes, Titanic, you try me to the..."
"That was a good man out there, Princess. One of my best..."
"One of my best," she corrected him.
He drew a deep, trembling breath, sheathed his knife.
"And what of my transport pilot?"
"This will be ascribed to an accident," she said. "You will advise him to employ the utmost caution when he brings those tigers back to us. And, of course, when he has delivered our pets to Javid's people on the transport..."
She looked at his knife.
"Is that an order, Princess?"
"It is."
"Shall I, then, fall on my knife, or will you take care of that, detail?"
She spoke with a false calm, her voice heavy.
"Titanic, were I not absolutely convinced that you would fall on your knife at my command, you would not be standing here beside me, armed."
He swallowed, stared at the screen. The tigers once more were feeding. She refused to look at the scene, continued to stare at Titanic as she said,
"You will as well tell our buyers not to bring us any more matched pairs of children who fit the necessary description."
"As you command, Princess."
"Don't use that tone with me, Titanic."
"Yes, Princess."
Her lips drew into a straight line. Then,
"How many more of those paired costumes do we have?"
6 sets of the robes, complete with still suits and the sand shoes, all with the Atreides insignia worked into them."
"Fabrics as rich as the ones on that pair?"
She nodded toward the screen.
"Fit for royalty, Princess."
"Attention to detail," she said. "The garments will be dispatched to Arrakis as gifts for our royal cousins. They will be gifts for my son. Do you understand me, Titanic?"
"Completely, Princess."
"Have him inscribe a suitable note. It should say that he sends these few paltry garments as tokens of his devotion to House Atreides. Something on that order."
"And the occasion?"
"There must be a birthday or holy day or something, Titanic. I leave that to you. I trust you, my friend."
He stared at her silently. Her face hardened.
"Surely you must know that. Who else can I trust since the death of my husband?"
He shrugged, thinking how closely she emulated the spider. It would not do to get on intimate terms with her, as he now suspected his Levenbrek had done.
"And Titanic," she said, "one more detail."
"Yes, Princess?"
"My son is being trained to rule. There will come a time when he must grasp the sword in his own hands. You will know when that moment arrives. I'll wish to be informed immediately."